which mother had told me was, when you see children happy, that is the sign that children are progressing. And one general remark I can make is that every child that I saw was happy. Even in new creation, the children who have been absorbed from the surrounding villages, their exuberance, they gave a dance performance, and the force with which they dance, and the rhythms which they produce, they express tremendous joy in their heart. So I feel that children are being looked after very well. I had the chance to meet children like Devatma, who is here before me, and Isabel and Shakti, and I think I am now remembering many, many names because of the imprint they have made on me. You know, when the children enter into your being, it means that they are vibrating with so much of the awakening that they can communicate with you without words. And there was one child, when I was speaking, was so concentrated. I have hardly seen such a concentration. I felt that every word that I was speaking was absorbed. It's like the dry land receiving the rains. So that is my first observation about what is happening in education here. This is my personal feeling. Similarly, I found among teachers a great sense of responsibility and dedication. I can tell the parents, your children are in very good hands. The teachers are looking after children with full heart. The kindergarten which I visited this morning was a marvelous experience. It is perhaps the ideal structure, the ideal environment, and the children were so happy. I have told Sanjeev that he should give me a blueprint of the structure of the architecture of this kindergarten. It can be a good thing which can be replicated in the country. So well organized, so well arranged. I am sure much thought has gone into the organization of this kindergarten. I have gone to transition, I have gone to law school. The further question that is in my mind is, if such is the condition, why should some parents feel that their children should be now sent away from here? I had some marginal discussion on this question with some people. And although I'm not satisfied with the answers that are given, I can understand to some extent why this has happened. But I will not go into this question just now. What is needed now is to take this experiment further. I went to Miramukhi, for example, this evening, this afternoon, this morning. It's a marvelous work, how silence can be the instrument of awakening the children. The tranquility that reigns in that area. And the speech is so soft. It's almost like whispering. We had in the ashram school at one stage a very powerful wave of experimentation where the one word which was supreme was Ceylon. There was a period when all lectures were suppressed in that school at all the level. And the idea behind it was that it is in the atmosphere of silence that the true knowledge is born. Knowledge is not an article that can take birth when the mind is agitating itself. There is a place for the mind in agitation. But we have not tapped the powers of silence. That experiment was a kind of a revolution. Mother had warned us in advance, saying that in a few weeks or in a few months, a storm will sweep over the entire school and teachers will find themselves earth slipping away from under their feet. And I can tell you, at least for me, that when this experiment was proposed, the earth really slipped away from under my feet. It was a fact. How to suppress all lectures and yet communicate and yet to educate? The answer that was given at that time was that whatever teacher wants to teach or whatever he wants to communicate should be written down. This experiment was to start in the month of December. It was in October the decision was taken. And teachers were required to write down their first lesson in a special form which was called worksheet. Within a period of 1 month and a half, and the very first day I was required to give in a type form 750 worksheets at different levels of study. It was not only a tremendous feat on the part of teachers who had no background of writing worksheets at all, but it was like a big workshop. And teachers were writing down, correcting, getting typed, again retyped, and a tremendous work was done within 1 month and a half. I cannot tell you and cannot communicate to you the atmosphere that reigned in our school at that time. Particularly when this whole idea was challenged in our own school by a number of teachers. How can you teach without talking? What is wrong in talking? What is wrong in lecturing? And this debate went on in the school for nearly 4 years. In the meantime, there was a great effort to prepare what is called worksheets of various kinds. And the most important variety of worksheets was what was called heuristic worksheet. And we all learned this for the first time. What is a heuristic worksheet? At least I never knew the word heuristic. It was Pavitrata who took me to his room and explained to me what is a heuristic worksheet. And I discovered that a heuristic worksheet was one in which the teacher presents the learning material in such a way that while reading, the student has to make a discovery. Unless a child makes a discovery at every few steps, the child cannot read the worksheet. You write a sentence, you write another sentence and leave a gap, you write a third step and put a question mark, you write a fourth sentence and you give some facts, by application of which you will be able to fill the gap and answer the question. Everything is there in the worksheet. The answers are there, questions are there, but they are all hidden. And the teacher has to write in such a way that the child, when he reads, it must be first of all interesting, otherwise people won't even read. It must be interesting material, and it should be written in this fashion. When we speak of educational research, I think this was one of the greatest experiments in educational research, where hundreds of worksheets were written, hundreds of worksheets. And after Pavitrada had explained to me, he gave me the charge, now we explain this to all the teachers, how to write. I had only learned for one day, and immediately asked me, he said, now you explain to all the teachers how to write heuristic worksheets. So within about a week's time, I had to attain some kind of mastery over heuristic writing. And then teachers after teachers, I used to meet them and explain to them. And the ultimate aim had to be remembered that this is to encourage silence of the mind. Intellectual activity, which was involved in reading the worksheet, was one side. But the ultimate aim was to develop silence of consciousness. The writing should be such as to induce the calm in the child, not agitation in the mind. Now, this was a much more difficult task. How to write in such a way that there is no agitation of the mind. There is inducement of calm and tranquility and discovery of knowledge as if we are rising up. I myself wrote a number of worksheets at that time, I can tell you that it was in 4 years' time when this debate raged in the school. It was like Mahabharata. It is a controversy, you know, I can see that when education is disturbed, everybody is an educationist. Everybody has studied. Everybody has experience of education. And everybody feels that the way in which he learned was perhaps the best way. When you look back, you always find that, oh, this I think struck me very much because it was in this condition. Therefore, that is the right method of learning. And if you put 20 teachers together, everyone feels that this is the right way. This method, as opposed to lecture method, occupied our experimentation for a long time. And there was an irony in the sense that the teachers who advocated silence, some of them, at the end of the experiment, said, il faut parler, il faut parler, il faut parler. This is an irony that shows how much experience was gained, and there was a real synthesis. You have to have a kind of an understanding that there is no rigidity, you should have no rigidity. While silence can be the source of knowledge, it is not only by suppression of speech that alone can bring you silence. There are deeper means of silencing and different levels at which silence of the mind can be attained. At one time, you know, this method was applied also in engineering. You know, in engineering particularly, this was a big challenge. It is even on the higher level of education. And we had very eminent teachers for engineering. Those were eminent engineers. There was Pradyodha, who was the chief electrical engineer of one of the biggest projects of India. And he was the teacher of electrical engineering in our school. Udar, as you know, many people know Udar very well. He was also one of the teachers. Vishwanatha was a teacher. All of them eminent engineers. Now, they had very difficult questions in their mind. How to teach engineering without talking? And as you know, engineers are always very inventive. In fact, Buddha took a question to the mother and said, "Mother, please tell me, what is the relationship between speech, writing worksheets, communication, and birth of knowledge in the state of silence?" And mother's answer was as follows, which is very enlightening. You first of all raise a question and put before the students as a project. Then you tell the children the relevant material which they should read to answer that question. When that material is gathered in the mind, then the mind should be silent. It is not as if all the time you attain to silence of the mind. But for that specific question, once you have read a good deal of material and collected it, then you try to silence your mind. Don't agitate. Don't cogitate. But with a deep sense of inquiry. That is to say, your material should lead you to a deep sense of inquiry. And put that question. And then keep absolutely quiet. And mother said, in that state of quietude, the answer will be born. And the real learning experience will take place. In fact, this is the answer which reconciles the conflict between teaching through worksheets and teaching through parole by talking. In the process of collecting material, you can talk to children, but not for the sake of creating agitation or cogitation of the mind, but by providing materials, by raising questions. It is not as if talking has no meaning and no value. Even talking or even hearing a talk can induce a state of silence. It is not that only when you don't talk, silence is induced. Sometimes it is the contrary. the mind begins to churn out so many thoughts because there's nothing to hold the mind on any specific point. But when somebody talks, your mind can be fixed on a topic. So there is no general dogmatic rule about it. And that was very important. Normally, what happens is, and Mahabharata takes place only when there are strong, rigid stands taken by people. This versus this. If this, then the other one is excluded. But we had to pass through a long process in which you might say we arrived at the following conclusions. What is the place of a lecture? What is the place of a worksheet? What is the place of silence in the process of learning? As far as my own personal learning is concerned, I can say that what I learned from this experience was that lectures are useful for only a few specific purposes. First, when you want to introduce a subject. Second, when you want to initiate a discussion about a subject. Third, when you want to create a collective atmosphere with regard to a subject. Fourth, when you want to give a resume. And fifth, when you may have made a research in a subject and you are fresh with the knowledge, and when you communicate through a lecture, as Sri Aurobindo said in one of his aphorisms, knowledge is invincible when it is fresh. When you have made research and you have arrived at certain conclusions, when the knowledge is fresh and you speak, it is really invincible. Now, I found that apart from these purposes, when lectures are given, they are irrelevant. They are boring. Children look at the time, their watch all the time. Or they look out through the window on what is going on outside in the world. Like that young boy in the story of Tagore. I don't know if you read the story called The Post Office. This is a drama written by Tagore called Post Office, in which a child is sick and the doctor has come and said that this child should not move out even an inch out of the room. He is almost like in a prison. And the boy, his soul is soaring out. He wants to fly in the sky. And here you imprison the child. The whole story revolves around the idea of imprisoning the child and child's wish to fly freely. In fact, this is the real state of every child, basically. Unless the child is spoiled, every child wants to fly. That is the movement of the soul. Its kinship is with the sky, because the soul is as vast. Its only equivalent is the sky. Therefore, it's a natural kinship. Like a bird, it wants to fly. Therefore, to imprison the child, and lectures could be imprisoning, because you ask a child now to sit down and listen to something which is being communicated through a lecture. This is a misuse of an instrument which can be useful otherwise. As I told you, if you reduce your utilities of lecture into these five categories, then it's a very useful instrument. But the moment you extend that use into something else, you want to explain something, you go on lecturing. I remember when I was attending, when I was a student of history at one time. I was 16 years old at that time. And my teacher of history, he started lecturing on history. And as you know, usually the teachers in the classical method, they go in a very classical way, expounding what is history, definition of history. And there are 7, 8 definitions which are given. So-and-so has said history is this, so-and-so has said history is this. The children do not even know what is the history. They have not read anything, or they have read very little. And you start by saying, definition of history which has been given by greatest historians who have mastered the whole of history. But in the very first lesson, you get all kinds of definitions. Then you are told, now discuss those things. Secondly, he started by saying the sources of history. First is definition of history, then the question is of sources of history. And the teacher started saying that there are two very ancient ages of history, the Paleolithic and the Neolithic. And then one of the most important sources of knowledge about this is the stone and the implements which are made of the stone and the terracotta. In fact, that was the first time I heard about terracotta in my life. When you don't even know what is terracotta, and the teacher says the terracotta is a source of knowledge of history. But this is the way in which history is taught. So the only thing that happens is the child becomes completely dry about the whole subject of history. You never feel inclined to read history. In fact, I always feel the textbooks are the worst enemies of education. Because textbooks give you a very defined, it is not that the textbooks are useless, but textbooks as something to be presented to the child is wrong. Once we had a very good insight into this subject when a very beautiful book on mathematics appeared in France, Mathématiques Modernes, that was the title of that book. It was a beautiful book. And Pavitrada, he himself was a great mathematician and he had read this book. And he suggested that this book now should be introduced in classes 5, 6, 7, 8. It was a big book, but the book had to be introduced there. Now, exactly at that time, there was a big controversy in our school about medium of instruction, whether it should be French or English. And again, there was a Mahabharata on this subject. A real war. I mean, so many teachers who did not know French always found that French was being imposed. And it was argued that because Pavitrada is a Frenchman, therefore French has to be imposed upon this. This was absolutely illegitimate. But you know, human nature is like that. Everybody is critical, basically, and teachers particularly are very critical. And I have seen that when you don't know a language, you always feel a resistance to it. You always feel that somebody is imposing upon you. And a number of teachers in our school, they did not learn French sufficiently well. Even for me, it took many, many years before I could be thrust into French. To learn a language also is difficult. Now, this book was in French. And some teachers said that this book, why should it be introduced in our school? Particularly when this book is very costly. Now you see how the language controversy, basically it was a question of language, the resistance to language. But difficult to say, because it is French, we don't want it. Then there was a subterfuge. And the argument was, when such books are available in English, and which are much, much, much cheaper, then why not to teach mathematics through English? It will be very economical. And question of language is very minor. After all, whether you learn in English or French, what difference does it make? Anyway, this controversy raged for about a month. In the meantime, these books were not bought. And then, when the controversy reached a very great climax, then somebody requested Pavitra Sahab, please put the question to the mother. And that too impartially. As though he was going to interpolate in favor of friends, and then mother could be persuaded because of some pressure. If you put in this way, the answer will be this way. If you put it in this way, the answer will be in that way. These ignorant ideas, you know, which were so much sometimes raging also. So Pavitra Das simply put the question. It was written down so that nobody can say that he put a question in such a way that mother would say that no, French is necessary or anything of the kind. Pavitra Das himself, because I had a very intimate relationship with him, and he had told me, he said, Kirit, I have no difficulty at all if mathematics is taught through English. Although it was our policy for a long time that mathematics and science should be taught through French, English through English, French through French, and history and geography through English, and mother tongue through the mother tongue. This was our normal policy. But when this controversy was very high, then this question was put to Pavitra Das, and he told me, he said that I have no difficulty at all from my side. Anyway, he took this question. The question was well drafted, well defined, so that it can be seen that it was transparent, impartial, and there was no weightage given in this way or in that way. And the mother kept the book with her for 2 days. Both French book and the English book, both. This was costly, that was cheap. Both the books were kept. After 2 days, mother said, this French book is far, far superior. This was her answer. So that was decided that this now French book had to be studied. Then Pavitra Das ordered 5 copies of the book because it was a very costly book. So we could afford only 5 copies of the book. So now came the turn of those teachers who still felt uneasy about it. They said, if there are only 5 books, how can we teach our children? We should give 1 copy to every child. So we had to buy, there was a proposal, we should buy about 30 copies of the book. And that would mean a tremendous budget, 30 copies, very, very costly. So once again, Pavitra Das went to the mother and said, mother, this is a big question. Shall we therefore not switch over to English book? But then came a reply which has struck in my heart very deeply. And that is relevant to the question of our text. Mother said, that textbook is meant for the teachers and not for the students. It's a real illumination in my heart. Textbooks are meant for the teachers and not for the students. Let the teachers read the textbooks, and then having read it, let them write special worksheets for the student. In such a way that the worksheets are appropriate to child's inquiry. Now this was, at that time I learned, and I remembered my experience of my history learning, where my teacher was giving lectures on history on a textual basis. Then I realized that history should not be taught in a textual manner. According to the questions that the students have in their mind, A teacher who knows history quite well, he has read textbooks very well, he should write in a very interesting manner so that the child's interest in history is awakened. Now, this meant a tremendous program for teachers, but I tell you, it was so beneficial to all the teachers of mathematics and students. I think that our students learned mathematics so well through this method. Now, having said this, the meaning of worksheets, teaching through worksheets, became much more clear to me. It is not merely a question of keeping silent and yet communicating. It is to put upon the teachers a greater task of digesting the whole material of the subject and communicating to the child and to every child separately, because if you lecture, then individualized learning becomes very difficult. Different children have different questions. And education becomes truly fruitful when it is individualized. Not that every education, every aspect of education should be individualized. That is another dogma. Because those people who say that education should be individualized completely, one-to-one relationship, that is also a dogma. Just as you can say that you can lecture, and it is also true, in a lecture you can lecture to thousands of people at once, true, and everybody could be benefited. So to say that it is only when you have one-to-one education, then only education is very fruitful, that is also not true. There are certain things which you can broadcast to thousands of people at once, true. It can create a tremendous wave, electricity in fact, and lots of insights can be created. That also is possible. So, one thing that I learned, and what mother once told me, she said there should be no dogma in education. To say only this is the method or that is the method. And then I happened to read at one time, just at that time, Sri Aurobindo's book called The Synthesis of Yoga. In fact, this is a book which I regard as the greatest book on education. Because education is yoga, yoga is education. Therefore, The Synthesis of Yoga is the greatest book on education. And there Sri Aurobindo's one sentence is very powerful. The teacher has no method and every method. This is the key sentence. Has no method and has every method. It takes you out of all dogmatism about education. In fact, if you remember this proposition, all controversies about education can cease. I myself learned this precious lesson after a long experience and long raging of a battle. Then I realized the meaning of this. It says that good teacher has no methods and every method. Now I'm saying this because every teacher here knows that our field is a field of experiments. And this is what I found in every school that I visited. Every teacher knows that he or she is making an experiment. There is a search. In fact, since mother has said that Oroville is a field of experiment, field of research, and since Oroville itself is a place of continuing education, I found this underlying current among all the teachers whom I met. Every teacher is trying to find out the right method of communicating. Even in the school of new creation, they are employing new methods of teaching language to Tamil children, where children are not taught the alphabet, but words directly. The children are slots. So we